Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quite a few good mathematicians leave the front lines of research and move into the lucrative world of high finance. No one has done this more successfully than the American Jim Simons. He was one of the world's leading algebraic geometers before he left mathematics research to set up Renaissance Technologies, a move that made him one of the wealthiest people in America. With his wife, Simon set up a philanthropic foundation that has funded a lot of basic research, especially into mathematics, fundamental physics, and their many connections. This relationship is the central theme of my new book, The Universe Speaks in Numbers. My name is Graham Farmlow, and this is another of the interviews with the leading players in the field recorded over the past year. Last autumn, I spent a week at the Simon Center for Geometry and Physics at Stony Brook University on Long Island. It was there that Jim Simons and the great physicist Frank Yang made pioneering contributions to approaches to gauge theories of physics using the mathematical discipline of topology. I was invited to the Simon Center by its director, Luis Alvarez Gomez, my guest today. Born, raised and educated in Spain, he's a top-class theoretical physicist and one of the pioneers of the string framework for understanding the fundamental concepts of the natural world. And he's a thoughtful, lively talker and a welcoming host, as I found out during my stay at the center, where mathematicians and theoretical physicists work alongside each other and sometimes together. I began the interview by suggesting that the center's founders were in some sense turning back the clock by centuries to times when there was no hard and fast distinction between mathematicians and physicists.
Well, I think that nowadays it's a bit difficult. There are very, very few people that are able to do really, you know, competitive mathematics and high quality physics. I think probably the exception is Edward Witten. Mm. He's someone who is a very reputed theoretical physicist, who is the only one ever to get a Fields Medal. So I think that what is important is that somehow, at least in the physics community, we have to get a level of mathematical sophistication that is kind of unusual. It was not like this.
So you think you're on a quest to actually improve that, are you, right, in some sense? Yeah. Ah, right, okay.
So mm-hmm. I think that this level of sophistication is something which is kind of unique to this period. I think that many theoretical physicists are using some of the tools that mathematicians are developing in the last, 10, 15, 20 years. And even better, like with the case of Poincaré and other great mathematicians, theoretical physics is becoming a source of inspiration, kind of experimental mathematics for the mathematician. I mean, many of the developments in theoretical physics, be it string theory or quantum field theory, have really inspired a large amount of mathematics and vice versa. So in that sense, it's a good time to bring both communities together.
I knew that the Simons Foundation had largely bankrolled the center, but I wondered where the idea had come from.
The seeds of the center is the summer workshop. Starting in the early 2000s, there was a summer workshop where brought Kunrun Waffa, Martin Rocek, and a certain number of people.
So these are leading people in string theory and
mathematical physics. And somehow this experiment of a whole month, 4 weeks dedicated to
hot houses in-house,
is what actually generated the inspiration to make the center. And therefore, in that sense, it's kind of unique. Well, we have some other centers in the world, like the IHS in Paris, the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, maybe MSRI or KIT in Santa Barbara. But in a sense, the idea was to create the outgrowth of the summer workshop was precisely this institute.
But it's a completely different matter to have a whole permanent institute. Well,
absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was felt that somehow there was the need, and perhaps Stony Brook was a very good place where there was plenty of interaction between the time of Yang.
Simons, you had great people here. Yeah.
So somehow historically, Stony Brook, there's been a very productive interaction between physicists and mathematicians. So again, this is part of the history of this place.
So how did it take off then? How did you get the money to do that?
Well, I think that this thing, of course, is an outgrowth of Jim Simons' obviously resources.
Let's just pause about Jim Simons, because he really is quite an unusual character, right? Because he was a very, very good mathematician.
He is,
at Stony Brook here.
He continues to do mathematics, in fact.
He still does it, does he?
He does it, you know, not as frequently as he used to do, but he was the person who somehow built 50 years ago the math department.
Yeah.
He brought extremely good people.
When he was a pure academic, yeah.
Pure academic, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then eventually he left Stony Brook, and then he went into, I think he worked for, I don't know, in cryptography. Then he went into, you know, all this financial mm-hmm. mathematics, and then became a very wealthy benefactor.
Extremely wealthy, yeah. Right. The hedge fund renaissance technologies, I mean, this is exactly. very so, big, yeah.
But, you know, someone who spends most of his money in fundamental research. It's interesting that he doesn't seem to care about applied research. So in a sense, it's wonderful the fact that someone who really thinks that curiosity-driven research is the one that should really be supported.
Yeah, yeah. Well, didn't he get his degree here, his first degree?
He was in MIT or Harvard.
Oh, was it? Okay, beg your pardon. But he has a certain loyalty to Stony Brook, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the math department here is really one of the top places in the country.
So how did Jim Simons help to make the centre happen?
Essentially, as I say, about 2005, 2006, 2007. I mean, the first document where the university and the Simons Foundation decided to work together to create the center. I mean, it's important that the university also believed in this project and is providing a large amount of support. I think that, you know, the president and the provost of the university should be thanked for this. The first document is essentially in 2009. That's when they set up the agreement, how this is going to work. And this fantastic building that where we are sitting now, I think that was built by Jim Simons with Simons Foundation, and it started functioning in 2010. So before, the Simons Center was squatting offices in the math and physics department.
Then you had your own purpose-built accommodation.
Right. And then we have this magnificent building where we can have all our activities, and in fact we host large numbers of workshops, programs, and somehow we have an important component that is service to the community. Because, I mean, the good thing is that our operations budget allows to fund workshops and programs, and those who are accepted do not need to worry about applying to funding agencies to get the funds.
That's a big bonus these days,
isn't it? It's a big bonus.
And you joined this, was it two years ago? It's 2016?
2 years ago, yeah. September 2016. So I've been here for 2 years. For me, it's like homecoming, because I came here 40 years ago as a graduate student in 1978.
Wow, yeah.
So it's kind of interesting that, in fact, many of the professors whose lectures I attended are still active. So as I said, for me, it's like a homecoming. I left here in 1980, then went to Harvard, then to 1 year in Boston University, then I've been at CERN, in the main laboratory in Geneva, for nearly 30 years. And it's kind of remarkable that eventually I closed the circle by coming back in, you know, the last part of my scientific career to Stony Brook, which is where I started.
Most of the experts in the overlapping territory between modern mathematics and modern physics were trained either as mathematicians or as physicists. But I wonder if deep down the experts at the centre tend to revert to the customs and practices of the field in which they were trained.
I think that, of course, you know, it's very difficult to imagine mathematicians writing rigorous papers with physicists. But I think what is important is to be each other's inspirations. You know, you don't have to write a paper or to conduct a program together, but it's very useful often to talk to them to see how they see the problem that we deal with and vice versa. So, and here, in a sense, mathematicians go about doing mathematics and physicists go about doing physics, but they interact frequently and it's in a very spontaneous way. It's not forced. So that's a good aspect about this center.
I imagine there's a lot of, you have to put a lot of faith in your people here, because you can't make them do anything, can you?
No.
All you can do is create an environment for them.
Right. That's the good thing about research. You know, precisely that's the way it works. I mean, people don't want to be disturbed. And then the important thing is you try to make sure that they have the best working conditions. And
what does that entail, incidentally, here? Because some people might be interested in that. What do people want as part of their environment? What are the key things that you have to give them, do you think?
Freedom.
Really? Number one thing, freedom. Just do whatever you like.
Yes, academic freedom. Just, in a sense, what we do and we get paid for, in a sense, is daydreaming. You're like, that's crazy.
very, very highly disciplined daydreaming, but yeah, I get the point, yeah.
But in a sense, that's what the British people want. You know, in principle, if they want some obligation, if they want to teach, they want to run a seminar and so on, of course, many of them do. But, the issue is that you just give them the resources so that they can be relatively happy.
Maybe it sounds trivial, but they want things like, you know, they want very good computer facilities.
Yeah, sure.
You know, they need family support and...
This center is for theoretical work, so it's much easier. You know, if they want a laboratory and so on, or a supercomputer, is an issue.
Yeah.
But it's relatively, you know, the resources that are needed to facilitate their work is relatively simple.
Okay.
You know, some traveling money, possibility of hiring graduate students, that's also shared with the university.
Mm.
So in a sense, you know, a good office, a reasonable salary so that you can keep your family happy. But apart from that, the most valued thing is precisely the freedom, the academic freedom, that nobody's going to tell them, you know, you have to publish, you have to make patents, you have to this, you know, just think about good problems.
Álvarez Gómez did what has become perhaps his most famous work in the 1980s, when he was one of the pioneers of the string framework. With the great mathematical physicist Edward Witten, Álvarez Gómez probed deeply into the conditions that enable a theory of gravity to be, unlike Einstein's, consistent with quantum mechanics. What does Álvarez Gómez remember about those days?
That was a paper where we were trying to explore consistency conditions in quantum field theory. You know, sometimes there are some properties of nature which is called chirality, which is the fact that, you know, the left... You know, the mirror image sometimes does not describe the real world. Then that sets a number of consistency conditions in when you try to have gravitational interactions or electromagnetic interactions and so on. So this is a work that we did. In fact, actually, Edward Witten was the leader. Obviously, he's the one who brought me into this particular
thing. Where was this? Was this in Princeton?
In Princeton,
in Princeton, yeah.
And the idea is that, you know, until then, nobody has really taken the possible inconsistencies in the case of gravity. Now, the interesting thing about that work is that, of course, in four dimensions, the one we're supposed to be living at least for the large dimensions, the gravitational anomalies were not particularly well studied or not were not providing very, very strong constraints.
Are you saying here that these quantum field theories were breaking down in the presence of gravity?
Yeah. Exactly. It's like, you know, the something similar when you have the other interactions, like a strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions. That as soon as you want to have some chirality, some you know, the fact that the left and right
handedness
is different, then there are some inconsistent quantum inconsistencies when you try to do the quantum theory. Well, what we did is to actually extend that work to include gravitation. And the interesting thing is that in dimensions which are, you know, 2, 6, 10, you know, the constraints are extremely strong. And in fact, that's what eventually led to the construction of the heterotic strings and similar things, that there are so few in 10 dimensions. So in a sense, you know, in that paper, it's the first time that somebody really studied what are the quantum constraints to have this consistent interaction with gravity and chirality.
So was Álvarez Gómez surprised in the summer of 1984 when Michael Green and John Schwartz came up with the first truly viable string framework?
Not really. It was kind of a relief.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But, I mean, of course, type 2B is very interesting, and in fact, is the basis for what we now call the ADS-CFT correspondence.
Mm.
So that, you know, type 2B continues to play a central role. But once this anomaly cancellation happened, then we discovered completely new string theories that were not known, and then that led to, you know, all this string revolution from 1984 on.
It was time to look at the bigger picture. Since the mid-1980s, fundamental theoretical physics has become steadily more mathematical. Does Álvarez Gómez have any sympathy for scientists who think that this mathematical trend has just gone too far?
Well, you know, there are all these kind of common sense, like Dirac. I mean, as you know, you certainly know much about Dirac or the Greeks or Galileo, that somehow the language of the world is written in mathematics. I mean, as Einstein used to say, you know, it's... the most incomprehensible thing about nature is comprehensible.
This is the Einstein quote, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's really surprising that good mathematics describes properties of nature. I don't think we have a good understanding of that, but it's extremely effective. I mean, in fact, Wigner wrote this fantastic, this article whose best part is the title, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. The rest of the article you can ignore, but that title is fantastic.
Great title. Great article, shame about the article. Yeah.
The title is the best part of the article.
But I'm not making trouble, I'm just intrigued. For people who think, try to work out what it's like to work in it, but you don't have experimental seminars here, do you? You don't have people worrying about
things. Once in a while.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Oh, right, okay.
Because, you know, I think that... Well, sometimes what happens is that, I mean, there's some questions about quantum field theory that do explain experiments.
Yes.
So, and there are some issues that, for example, you cannot access theoretically because we still don't have the tools, and then you need experimental input to guide you. So in that sense, it's kind of interesting. We've had a few of these workshops, which are dedicated to explain things that happen in the LHC, you know, the Large Hadron Collider. And somehow the various experiments who are really trying to explore the frontier and go beyond. So in that sense, sometimes, you know, you just talk to your theoretical colleagues, to mathematicians, but often it's very important to question nature, which at the end of the day in physics is the oracle.
Do you not think there's a reasonable case to say that it is perhaps a worrying development that theoreticians now establish a great career without going anywhere near an experimental result?
Sure. No, that's true. It's true. You know, it's an interesting question. But for example, many people are always criticizing string theory, no contact with nature and so on. That, I think, is a huge exaggeration. I mean, I'm not going to become a Popperian or defend Popperians or non-Popperians, but the number of tools, mathematical and otherwise, that have come out of string theory haven't reached mathematics and what you might call real physics in a way that was totally unexpected.
Yeah, so you're saying it's been beneficial to the subject as a whole.
Absolutely. I can tell you, for example, that some of the things which is called the theory of amplitudes, I'm not going to get into. In fact, Edward Witten made a fantastic piece of contribution.
You're talking about fundamental particles basically colliding with each other in
But, you know, said before, some of this recent work on amplitudes that was inspired by string theory, you know, the computation, for example, of proton-proton collisions in the LHC with a number of jets coming out in the final state were essentially impossible to calculate. Now we can go up to 7, 8, 9, 10 jets with incredible facility. I mean, facility, but, you know, we can do it. And in the 1990s, it was unthinkable.
Oh, so you ascribe that success. Then.
Right. That's a fantastic success. Without all this technology developed and inspired by string theory, these computations that allow us to really explore the LHC would not be possible.
Many of the most advanced mathematical developments are predicated, to some extent, on supersymmetry. A mathematical symmetry proposed to be at the heart of the natural world. Yet experimenters at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN have so far discovered no evidence at all that this theory holds good in nature. Is Alvarez Gomei worried about this?
There was no reason why supersymmetry should be at 1 TeV or 5 TeV or 10 TeV and not at 1,000 TeV.
This is at the super Large Hadron Collider range.
Of course, you can always make the case that it is possible.
Good for funding applications.
Right, but there was no necessity. I think that's, you know, maybe we were a bit too naive in having these high expectations of Lorentz supersymmetry when even string theory does not require it.
Does it worry you as well? I'm talking a lot about worries here, but I mean, it is an unusual activity we're involved in here, after all, that, you know, theoreticians aren't pushing hard enough for these experiments, because, I mean, we really do, you know, if the Large Hadron Collider, which is a fantastic achievement, make no mistake, of experimental physics and engineering, but it hasn't given us any really big surprises, I think it's fair to say. It'd be delightful to see the Higgs
The surprise of the Higgs part.
That's great.
Because I think most people were, there's so many people who were skeptical about
that. That's true. That was wonderful. But we haven't had any really big...
Not yet.
That's fair point. But you know, it looks like to probe the Higgs sector more finely, we're going to need higher energy.
It would be great if, for example, somebody built a Higgs factory. You know, the Higgs, the LHC is like painting with a very broad brush. You miss many of the fine points. It would be nice to have a machine based on electrons and positrons, which is like a scalpel, to really explore the Higgs region. And then, you know, many of the parameters that are associated to symmetry breaking cannot be measured with enough precision at the LHC. That's where you could find new physics. Also, I mean, one has to be a little careful that, I mean, discovering a new law of nature, which is like the Higgs exchange and so on, is not something that happens every year or every month. So I think that now we may be in a period where perhaps once the LHC turns on, all of a sudden there's the royal fireworks. I think it's unlikely, because we are not going to increase the energy. So what happens is that very rare phenomena may be discovered or may be observed thanks to the fact that you have very high luminosity and many more collisions. To really discover supersymmetry, either we find it through, discovery of dark matter and some particular properties of dark matter, or by increasing the energy.
Finally, I asked Alvarez Gomei what would be his advice for an ambitious young theoretical physicist who wants to make headway at the subject's frontiers.
Bright people don't need guidance.
I didn't say only bright people.
No. Right, but I think that it's clear that, I mean, there are several areas which are very interesting now.
Yeah.
You can, of course, be motivated by these large facilities. Then you can, you know, there are all kinds of accelerators and so on. Some people get fascinated by that form of fundamental search. But some others prefer to have a slightly, you know, smaller groups of activity. Mm. And it's interesting that now we are discovering again, you know, condensed matter physics, same way that mathematics and theoretical physics have a lot of things in common. Condensed matter, mathematics, and quantum field theory, you like, have many interesting connections. Mm-hmm. And we've discovered all these new phenomena about, you know, vile semi-metals, Dirac semi-metals, topological insulators. So it's a whole plethora of new things that are coming out, which does not require large experimental facilities. Mm-hmm. Now, where the physics is, you know, it's really fascinating. Mm. So we're discovering new materials and new phase transitions and new behavior, quantum matter, that was totally unknown.
This has been a really big development in the last few decades, hasn't it? Where just as in the 70s, remember when cosmology and particle physics came together, now some of the most exciting action is with the physics of solids and the quantum theories of those. It's astonishing.
So that's a good thing. You know, that's one of these areas where many of these new discoveries in exotic properties of quantum field theory find application in materials that our friends in the condensed matter community can build. Okay. So that's an area which is very exciting. Of course, the question about continue with the cosmological search, the search of B-modes for the cosmic microwave background, all the new things that will come from the what they call multi-messenger cosmology, which includes neutrinos, gravitational waves, photons, and so on. I mean, this is the dawning of a completely new era. And whenever you open a new window, normally you find things which are fascinating.
I had a terrifically stimulating week at the Simon Centre. It's one of several relatively new institutions where theoretical physicists and mathematicians work alongside each other, benefiting from each other's knowledge, skills and perspective. Two other examples are the Institut des Hautes Études Scientifiques in Paris and the splendid Perimeter Institute in Waterloo in Canada, founded in 1999. These are places where huge amounts of great research are being done. Another demonstration of how effective it is to listen to the universe speak, not only in experimental data, but also in numbers.